I didn't know I was looking for you. I didn't know there was something to find. Tomorrow you won't fit in yesterday's shoes, and I'm trying so hard to rewind. You came to me as an empty cup. I didn't know love could ever be real. And every day I tried to fill you up with everything that I thought you would feel. Through the years, the sorrow, the joy that we borrow, the tears that we share with the rain. Oh, today, tomorrow, forever I'll follow your trail.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, listening to the music of Sean Rowe coming in. And, you know, I just wish his voice could be a little bit deeper. Sean Rowe is playing Putnam Place in Saratoga Springs in a benefit for Agricultural Stewardship Association on Saturday, 8/17. That is the 17th of August, and that is this Saturday. He is also playing at the Egremont Barn on the 23rd and at the Scaticook Fair on the 31st. You can find out more at Sean Rowe, SeanRowe.net. And it's Rao, actually. I'm saying Rowe, but it's Rao. Sean Rao.
And I was going to say, apologies. It's Scaticook.
Scaticook. No, Scaticook.
Scaticook.
Okay. All right. We can duke that one out later. That's fine. Good morning, everybody. It's Sean Rao, and it's SeanRowe.net. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being with us. We have a great panel. Let me introduce everybody, and we'll get started, and then we'll move on to the news of the day. There's a lot to talk about, even though the only thing I want to talk about is the Chris Cuomo story, but there is other stuff to talk about. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Primed and ready. Thank you, sir.
On everything All or right. just the Cuomo story?
whatever.
Berkshire Eagle reporter Jen Smith is here. Good morning, Jen.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm wonderful.
Edward Hamilton, distinguished professor of computer science at RPI and faculty associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University and Harvard Data Science Initiative Fellow, Fran Berman.
Hello.
So nice to have you.
Thank you.
And vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, longtime editor of the Daily Gazette, Judy Patrick.
Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome all. It's very, very nice to have you with us. All right. So we'll begin with the story that kind of broke while we were on the air yesterday, and then we've seen obviously seen the effects of President Trump on Tuesday unexpectedly put off new tariffs on many Chinese goods, including cell phones, laptop computers, and toys, until after the start of the Christmas shopping season, acknowledging the effect that the protracted trade war with Beijing could have on Americans. He pushed a 10% tariff on some imports to December 15th, and excluded others from it entirely, while facing mounting pressure from businesses and consumer groups over the harm they see the trade conflict is doing. The president had always maintained, you'll remember, that this would not have any effect on the consumer. Well, by doing this, you then say, oh, this is going to have an effect on the consumer. As a result, the stock market soared yesterday following weeks of volatility driven by fears that the standoff between the world's two largest economies could hamper global economic growth. So, the question, did the president blink?
The president blinked. Mm-hmm. Very, very, very easy to see. And, you know, and I don't think he likes to blink, but he had no choice in this case. I think China's in for the long haul. I think playing, you know, the tariff game with them is a losing battle for him.
Alan, what do you think?
No, I think that's right. You know, I have tremendous admiration for Judy. She's always on the.
There you go.
She's always on the money.
Obviously.
No, he blinked. Of course, he blinked. And you know, he's a liar. We all know he's a liar. His partisans know he's a liar. His objectors know he's a liar. What's astounding to me, and what is so disheartening, is it doesn't seem to matter. So he tells a big whopper, and you know, his people go back and say, well, that's right. He knew he had to do something, so he did something. So we don't have to worry about it.
But how do you not know, how did he not know that it would perhaps end up this way? In the sense of that he was going to have to go back because it wasn't going to end well.
Well, I suspect that he knows full well that he can say anything he wants and that he can reverse himself at will. He had to play it out with the Chinese because he knew that he was in this real estate game. I once read a piece about his daughter Ivanka. Saying she was in a room and he had told her exactly what to say. And she had said it. And he walked in the room and said, no, that's all wrong. So he gets away with it. He's a liar. The worst thing in the world is a liar. We all know it. And that's what he is.
Well, go on, Jen.
I think it's just this posturing game is only going to take anyone so far. And all of this move does is just drag everything out, because you can easily predict that, then China will slightly soften its stance, and there's no sign of actually going back to the negotiating table at all either. And then meanwhile, he's backing off on some of these tariffs, like on the consumer goods that say, makes him technically kind of look strong, like, oh, it's not going to affect the holiday season. But he still pushed through with his agricultural tariffs as well, like literally going after small potatoes.
String beans.
Yeah, there you go. So, what is the end result, and who's going to really actually benefit from this at all?
Yeah, but don't you just think he's just a, sort of a seat of the pants guy? He'll decide. Politically, it's a little bit too hot to make everybody suffer around Christmas. So let's not do that. And then maybe for some other reason at some other time, he'll decide, no, I need to look tough. Let's step it up. And, I think it's just really hard to build a strategy when, things are just noise, right? It all seems random. I don't think he's not the strategic one, and people who work for him might be strategic one, but they always have to adapt to, whatever, the flavor of the day is.
Fran, I have to, despite my incredible respect for you, I have to disagree on this, and that is, I think he does have a strategy, and his strategy is to be the jerk that he is because it got him elected president of the United States. And the New York Times says it's going to get him elected another time, or could get him elected another time as president of the United States.
Alan, that's do you his, think he does that on purpose, or do you
I
think
do.
That's
no,
the way
no.
he is?
No. I think he does it on purpose. And I think he does it on purpose.
And you have to understand that the farmers have taken the hits the last two growing seasons as these subsidies but they've required heavy subsidies. You have to understand that Trump has a great big piggy bank, the U.S. Treasury, to dole out subsidies to help these farmers get through when they can't sell their crops to China like they have in the past. But at some point, I think the farmers are going to say, our patience has run out and we need this to get resolved.
Well, and I think
based on what evidence?
Based on a second year of not planting crops, I think at some point, I think farmers are smart people, and I think they have abided by the policy, thinking that in the end they're going to be able to sell more crops at a higher price to China. They've been going along with the strategy, but if it continues to not work, they're gonna stop.
And this strategy is not equitable. I think the big thing to remember is to read the fine print on all these deals and these micro negotiations. He might back off on tariffs for one specific area, but it doesn't affect all retailers equally. So if you really look at the fine print, back to school shopping season, if you go to any mall or store, you're going to see people out there. And some of those things are being affected by tariffs, like footwear and apparel, some tech. Apple got a reprieve, but a lot of other technology.
Yeah, so did Best Buy. Mm-hmm. Best Buy really won on this.
So I wish you guys were right. I really do, because I agree that this is a terrible situation. It's a terrible man, terrible situation. But I don't think you see the forest for the trees. I think I think he is getting away with this, and his base is sticking with him. The farmers are sticking with him. You say at some point it's going to change. I don't think there's any evidence of that.
Well, what's your evidence otherwise, Alan?
My evidence, okay, then now you're being tough, and appropriately so. No, my evidence otherwise is that it's not happening. In other words, you know, I think a lot of people in, dare I say it, our camp are thinking that this can't go on, that sooner or later people will come to their senses and that they will stop. But the greater good for some of these people is the concept of privilege. They have it. They don't want to give it up. They're afraid of the others coming in and eating their lunch. And he knows that, and he plays to that, and that is a strategy, like it or not. So that all I can say is, you say it's going to happen. I say it is happening. There's a big difference.
Yeah, I think the president might be able to spin this as he's the guy who saved Christmas.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
But he caused the problem.
Yeah, I understand, but...
Well, and then that was the same thing that happened with the agriculture. We wouldn't be in this mess if we didn't start that initial, move. And again, I think all of this does is draw things out and create, more problematic long-term economic problems, and I think we're going to see more market volatility. And I think you're going to see that on your statements when you get your quarterly statements for your stocks and things like that. Who wins?
But I'm not surprised about this, about his base sticking with him, because I don't know everyone in his base. I don't know most people in this base, but I think his base has been largely disenfranchised. One of the reasons he got in, and one of the reasons he really spoke to them. And I believe that his base gets their information, like we all do, from a source that is sympathetic to their point of view. And so I think that his actions are interpreted in a really different spin than you hear if you listen to MSNBC or read the New York Times or, a lot of other things. And so I don't think his base, really sees this unless they feel it at their dinner table, in their wallet.
Their jobs.
Know. Yeah.
If their jobs ultimately affected, I think, that will make a difference.
Yeah.
You keep saying that. You see, the reason I don't think, first of all, Fran, I don't think you're right that his base is largely made up of the disenfranchised. I think there are certainly some, but I think that the large group of people, the Republicans, are the haves in this country, and they're scared to death that they're going to be the have-nots. That in the future they will be the have-nots, but they're the ones who have the resources right now. I don't see any evidence that these are the disenfranchised. On the contrary, I think that the Democrats, if you think about who is really on the lower end of the social scale and who doesn't have the health care and who doesn't have the rest of that, they're the disenfranchised. I don't see it.
I think that's a fair point, Alan, but I think his base includes both.
Yes, it does.
It includes both folks who have been disenfranchised, and I think that is maybe the lower economic scale of that base. And I think you're right. I think his pro-business approach is really welcome by a lot of haves. So, I think that's a fair point.
When it comes to actually coming to an agreement with Beijing, what do you think? Never?
Never. It's never going to happen because their long-term interests are different from our long-term interests. They're not going to change. And one of the issues is the U.S. wants them to codify, some of these trade secret rules into law. China's not going to do that. It's a point of pride in China, and that's much stronger than it is for Trump. And their president is going to be around a lot longer than our president.
For life. Well, wait, we don't. We
immortality.
Right. No, let's look at what the Chinese agenda is. We look at it in Hong Kong. I said on this panel a couple of days ago, you may remember, I thought that Xi and his regime would do anything that they had to keep the Communist Party in power, including come down tenement style on the people at the airport and the other folks at in Hong Kong. And I think time has proven me right. Everybody knew it, and they were going to be. So what I think the same thing is true in terms of staying in power economically. Are you following me? In other words, I think if they feel they have to give a little here, it's a lot different than giving something away at the Hong Kong airport, where that could spread to the rest of the Chinese society.
Hmm. Yeah, I heard a story this morning coming in about the way the Chinese are letting that information out to their own people. They were sort of silent on it for a long time, but then the thought was, they're hearing about it anyway, let's spin the story. And it's pretty interesting that they're really trying to make that narrative very pro-China, obviously, and very, you know, anti-protester.
Yeah, with martial music, by the way.
Yeah. Everybody needs a theme song, Alan. Yeah.
You know, what we haven't heard is a lot of discussion about the larger issues that Trump was after, is bringing manufacturing jobs back to the U.S., encouraging more of that, encouraging companies to relocate to the U.S. Mm-hmm. That hasn't happened to the degree that the Trump was initially suggesting it would happen. And those kinds of facts and figures are important for, you know, the base to understand or to at least acknowledge, but that's not happening. And
well, it gets gleaned over too. You know, you look at like just the local, you know, employment rates and things like that, and people are like, oh, you know, those numbers are going up. But you, again, like you said, you have to look at the nuance of it, and you have to have that understanding, and you also have to look at wages.
We should also note that as of now, there was this reprieve in these particular tariffs, but as of now, $112 billion of Chinese goods will be hit with a 10% levy on September 1st, and another $160 billion will be the subject of the tariff on December 15th. So there still is that to keep in mind.
But I think Judy's earlier point, and I hope it was Judy, my addled mind can't always keep up, but, you know, it is clear that the Chinese are keeping with their game plan. They are not changing a thing yet, but they may.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Alan Chartok, Jen Smith, Judy Patrick, and Fran Berman all here. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will continue our conversation after this short break. Hearing Sean Rao this morning, and he's going to be playing in our region. You can find out at seanrao.net and also see the playlist on our website, wamc.org/roundtable. Welcome back to the panel. Alan Chartok, Jen Smith, Judy Patrick, and Fran Berman. We welcome your letters. We have quite a few. Let me get to those, and we'll get started. Ricky says, hi, panel. Aren't these farm subsidies a form of socialism? Anyone?
We've always said so. That's correct.
Sadie says, how to understand the Donald's actions? I firmly disagree with Dr. Chartok because the president is a sociopath, and as such, his actions are not subject to rational analysis. His only strategy is self-preservation. His base is, however, subject to consideration, and Fran is right.
I don't think we're that far apart, to be honest with you.
Yeah, but no one ever says I'm right, Alan. Can I just enjoy the moment?
I'm a huge Fran fan, poetry. But I think he has a strategy, and I think that the writer is correct. His strategy is self-preservation.
Yeah.
And ladies and gentlemen, he's president of the United States. He got there with that strategy, right?
Absolutely. Russ writes, blowing smoke. Trump's single trade negotiation tactic, the threat of tariffs, has gained one outcome, the permanent dependence of commodity farmers on federal subsidies. Tariffs do alter trade patterns, but they do not alter trade deficits and foster the onshoring of manufacturing capacity in a world of complicated supply chains. If Trump's aim was to effect a trade deal with China, his policy has been a complete failure. China will just subsidize itself off to the U.S. off of the U.S. market.
And great, find great other letter. Markets. And they'll buy their soybeans from another country.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Great letter. If Trump's strategy was to get the Chinese to do this, it may not have been. It may have been that the Chinese become the boogeyman, right? And therefore, it doesn't matter what the policy outcome does. He wants to use them the same way he uses immigrants and everybody else to say to the in power group right now, we're going to take care of you. I don't know that he cares about the outcome.
Yeah, I mean, to that point, and to your point about strategy, I mean, this goes back to the 80s when he was, you say boogeyman, but he was making the Japanese out to be the boogeyman at that mm-hmm. point. And it's really the same playbook,
isn't it?
Doesn't matter.
Right. Right. Yeah. Exactly right. Doesn't matter who they are.
Yeah, there always seems to be one. Seems to need to be a villain.
Anne writes about re-election. Everything you are discussing, tariffs, etc., is about Trump running for re-election. Trump hits farmers, then provides subsidies. He's buying votes. Trump is making lots of money being president, in addition to his businesses that are still in operation. He works very little, and the money rolls in anyway. 4 more years of this easy job would be ideal for Trump, and he's not a thinker, so possible consequences escape him.
And the other reason that the 4 more years are important to him is that's 4 more years of not being indicted.
Right. there's that, too.
Because more and more people are coming around to my view, which I've had from the very first day, that the Justice Department's obiter-dictor, whatever word you want to use.
I like that one.
that you cannot indict a sitting president is just wrong. It's not in the Constitution. It's not anywhere. It is a simple policy by the Justice Department. It's self-serving. I don't care whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans. It's just wrong. No man, no woman is above the law. And he is now above the law because of that policy.
And it's going to take a lot of change on the Supreme Court and in the Senate to mm-hmm. ever change that, correct?
And if we have correct, and if we're going to go to another 4-year term, I hate to say this, ladies and gentlemen, but we are talking about at least 2 more Supreme Court inductees, and maybe 3, and maybe 4 forever.
Bernie writes about the economy. James Carville famously said during the Clinton administration, "It's the economy, stupid." If the economy is going strong through November 2020, Trump is in the best possible position to win.
Correct.
Democratic candidates propose many social and economic solutions that far outspend Trump's biggest expenditure, the wall. How will Warren or Sanders survive on the debate stage when those numbers are laid out to the American people?
I think the basic premise of the letter is correct. I think his strongest asset right now in terms of running for office is the economy, whether it – and don't be writing me letters, folks. I know it started with the Bushes and then was Obama and is now here. But right now it's his to claim, and he is claiming it, and I'm telling you it's working.
And yet we're seeing the stock market react this morning. The Dow is down 400 points on a report of concern about recession. So I know we always have to say that the stock market is not the economy and vice versa mm-hmm. and all that stuff. But, I mean, if you have a report that is talking about possible recession, that is of concern.
Yeah, that's what all the financial advisors are saying. I've been to my own financial advisors this
Uh-oh.
Summer. And all of them are saying, you know, be prepared. Things are going to tank.
Get ready.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If that happens, he is probably toast. But you can't count on it happening. And you see 400 points down one day, 350 up the next day. You know, it's a long distance between lip and cup here.
Yeah. It has been a roller coaster the last week. Joe writes about farmers and says farmers have voted against their best interests for years. Country mouse versus city mouse. Sad, but they were the first progressives years ago.
And farming has also changed dramatically. And there's mm-hmm. the big agribusiness. There's small farmers. There's, you know, the balance. There's precision farmers. Precision farming, which involves a lot of digital stuff. So, you know, I think our view, if we have such a view of farmers as a group of sort of small business owners, is really changing.
But there are a lot of people employed in the farming industry in key electoral states, and I think that's what's
well. That's the legacy groups, and I think that there's a lot of power there and a lot of struggle.
So Marty says, "What's the truth, dear panel?" Last night on Rachel Maddow's show, she pointed out that Trump, according to the polls, is underwater in Arizona, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, and in double digits underwater in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. If that is true, then why are you still saying Trump's base is solidly sticking with him?
Well, because when we poll his base, they are sticking with him. And while the writer is correct that he is underwater in all of the states that he won by, tiny little bits, the only election is Election Day. And I hate to say it, but the New York Times, which has great resources at its disposal, is able to take a look at this thing and say, right now, Trump could well win. It isn't what it is on this day. It's what it's going to be on Election Day.
And it's still way too early to tell. I think it's looking at the polls they're just as volatile as the stock market right now. And I think it's anything that can come out of the president's mouth. It's anything that, another, foreign government can fire back at us. That's going to keep that volatility in the polls. And not to mention, what his other contenders might say or do. Mm. I think it's still way too early to tell.
And I remember watching Rachel Maddow in the weeks before the 2016 election, her gleefully talking about how there was no way that Trump was going to win, and the poll showed him he was underwater here and there.
Well, I think and New York Times. I mean, mm-hmm. we all looked at that meter
mm-hmm.
every day, which said that there was a 12% chance that Donald Trump would be president of the United States, and it wasn't until like 9 o'clock where that that needle started to move higher and higher.
But there's three things in play here. There's the politics, which are going to influence how many people mm-hmm. think. There's who you poll. And, with all we've seen on voting rights and the number of people who are actually going to show up, that's likely to change. And then there's the voting models themselves. And a lot of the voting models were wrong for a whole bunch of different reasons, including that we'd never had an election like this before. So it's hard to use a previous model and assume it's going to work.
And some people lie to their mothers and they lie to their pollsters.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
There is
so
that.
So some of the data was bad.
Mm-hmm. And I had lunch with a guy the other day, and he started giving me a hard time saying, my obligation was to stop talking about this and just get everybody to vote. Well, that's right. Everybody's got to vote. And if they don't, and we know more Democrats don't vote than Republicans, and that could be the election.
And pollsters, in their defense, like to make the case that even if he only has a 12% chance of winning, that's still 12%. It's not zero. Mm-hmm.
And so there's a chance.
There's a chance.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We have many more items to discuss. Great conversation going forward. We go to we'll go to a break. Alan Chartok, Jen Smith, Judy Patrick, and Fran Berman are here. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Words have come from men and mouths, but I can't help thinking that I've heard the wrong crowd. When all the water is gone, my job.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us. So let us go to some other stories, and we'll talk about the Jeffrey Epstein story and two issues with this story. Jeffrey Epstein guards suspected of falsifying log entries. They have been reassigned. That seems like a good thing. The warden at the federal jail where Jeffrey Epstein took his own life over the weekend was removed Tuesday, and two guards who were supposed to be watching Epstein were placed on leave while federal authorities investigate the death. The move by the Justice Department came amid mounting evidence that the chronically understaffed Metropolitan Correctional Center bungled its responsibility to keep the 66-year-old Epstein from harming himself while he awaited trial on charges of sexually abusing teenage girls. Epstein was taken off a suicide watch last month for reasons that have not been explained and was supposed to have been checked on by guards every 30 minutes, but investigators learned those checks weren't done for several hours before he was found Saturday morning, according to a person familiar with the case who was not authorized to discuss it and spoke on the condition of anonymity. Excuse me. Guards on the unit are now suspected of falsifying log entries to show they were making the checks, according to another person familiar with the investigation. Surveillance video reviewed after the death showed guards never made some of the checks noted in the log, according to the person who also wasn't authorized to disclose information. And then there is the story this morning that one of the guards may have been asleep.
Mm-hmm. Right, because he was on his fourth or fifth day of overtime.
Right.
And that is never conducive to good work habits. And the other part is that we talk about the budget to the correctional facility being cut by something in the range of 11 to 15%. If you're constantly paying people for overtime, you're really blowing your budget. So why is it understaffed, and why haven't they resolved that root problem and made that prison a better functioning facility?
Mm-hmm. And I think that's the interesting thing about this case is, you know, how will you dissect it, and where will you actually shine lights on it? You know, there's going to be the side that says, well, you know, poor Epstein, you know, he wasn't given his proper care or you know, watch, and that's a fall of the system. But like, as you just pointed out, there's bigger problems with this system. And, you know, it'd be one thing, I'd be curious if the investigation does say that this is solely an issue with Epstein, or if it's a chronic issue within that whole facility.
Jen, are you really hearing that people are saying poor Epstein?
Well, I think his legal team is going to be pushing for that, and that they're probably the only ones who will. But, you know, I think...
Well, and those who wanted to know more from him and also wanted to face them to help in their own healing.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. And I think that's what it's this bigger issue is about is, you know, what happens next? What happens to the victims? What happens? Do they get their day in court? Or is that time cut short for them because of, you know, his fatality?
I'm trying to decide why this is newsworthy other than the fact that it's Epstein, because I think, you know, we've had a lot of experience with these systems, the federal systems, being understaffed and inefficient. If indeed conspiracy theories notwithstanding, if indeed that's the case, this happened in a very high profile instance. But if Epstein was, you know, another... less noteworthy, you know, person. You know, I mean, this would not be splattered all over the front page. And to me, the really sad part of this is, you know, we have the capability, we have the smarts, and as Judy points out, it doesn't cost all that much money, and sometimes it doesn't even cost any more money to make these systems efficient. But it's not the priority.
First of all, we all have to understand that the federal system is generally regarded as the Cadillac compared to the state system.
Right.
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 We know that if you want to commit a crime, better to commit a federal crime. Because you'll get into what is sometimes called club fed. Secondly, Shartok's rule, which is always capture, if you're gonna clean up a mess, always get the lowest level schnook on the food chain and make sure that they get transferred and they get punished, as opposed to whatever else may have been going on here that affects some of the most powerful people in the world.
So let me make a slight pivot, because Frey mentioned a moment ago about the conspiracy theories aside, but in my looking at of interesting tech stories to talk while we have our tech all-star here, I came across this Washington Post story that senators from both parties are deeply concerned that the conspiracy theories swirling online about Jeffrey Epstein's death, and even amplified by the president himself on Twitter, are playing right into Russian hands. The rush to spread baseless theories in the wake of Epstein's apparent suicide is what makes American society, quote, so vulnerable to disinformation and foreign influence threats. This, according to Senator Marco Rubio of Florida. Rubio asserted that Russia, as part of its long-running campaign to sow political division in the U.S., might be capitalizing on the death of the disgraced financier and accused sex abuser. To go on, the most shocking share of a conspiracy theory came from Trump himself, who retweeted a conservative anchor who suggested Epstein's death might somehow be tied to former President Bill Clinton and used the hashtag, quote, Clinton body count. Posts citing Trump body count implicating the president instead were also trending on Twitter.
Right.
How big a deal is this, Fran Berman?
It's a big deal, it's a huge deal, and it's a small deal, all at the same time, in my opinion. What it really shows is that marketing works. We've just known it for a long time. If people want you to believe someone something, if they want to persuade you of something, they're going to use whatever tools possible. And these days, digital media is a particularly good tool for this because there's very little accountability. You know, by and large, you don't know whether the source of the information is trustworthy. You don't know whether the information is trustworthy. You know, to me, the Russians have used this really well, but so have Americans and Chinese and people all over the world.
And Trump. Who's
and Trump himself. Exactly. So, you know, in some sense, we're trying to get at that. The whole Honest Ads bill brought by Klobuchar and Wagner and McCain in Congress says that if you have a political ad, the same rules have to happen online that they do in print and press and television. And, you know, that's something that's winding its way through. But that talks about accountability. If you talk to people in the tech industry, trying to figure out what's real and what's fake is super hard. It's as hard online as it is in real life. If I walk up to you, you know, on the street and tell you something, how do you know if it's true? How do you know who I am? Even if I give myself a fancy title or say I have credibility, you really don't know. And you really don't know what my intention is.
No, but you have a very fancy title.
Oh, thank you very much. I'll try to put some more on. Oscar winner.
Yeah.
Yeah, Grammy Award winner.
But there's the idea of going, I keep thinking of what you're saying, and then and just in regards to what Alan was talking about earlier when we were talking about Trump and the that feeding to the base. I mean, so by him doing this and peddling in conspiracy theories, and even though Marco Rubio may have a concern about playing into the Russians' hands, what does he care? What does Trump care?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, Trump has used this tool probably as masterfully as anyone. You know,
absolutely.
He's used it as masterfully as the Russians. You
absolutely.
Know,
now, you've raised the issue, Fran, of marketers. And I think it's a brilliant observation because I do think that's what this is all about. Can you name a single Democrat who is as good a marketer as Trump is?
You know, I've been struggling with this myself because I look at the 437, is that the count now, of Democratic candidates?
Yeah.
Quite a lot of them, not quite that many. And I'm trying to think on two kind of dimensions. One is, you know, whose platform and beliefs make sense to me as a voter? And number two, who's going to be electable? And, you know, that whole electability thing, which I think has to do with how they market themselves, how they come off, you know, do they seem like someone you would trust? Do they not seem like someone you trust? Do they seem like someone who would be level-headed and have a good strategy?
So who you got?
You know, I'm having a tough time, I have to say, Alan. I mean, there are candidates I like more than others, but there doesn't seem to be any clear, yeah, that's the person who could beat Trump to me.
What do you all make of the Houston Chronicle calling for Beto to drop out of the presidential race and run for Senate?
You know, I think Beto needs some more seasoning, and I think it would be great for him to get some more experience. I would love to see his point of view. I don't. For me, he's not a contender for president. Really,
I agree. Look, the guy has gone nowhere in the presidential race at all. I think he may have, in fact, damaged his chances to be elected senator. Although his polls are pretty good in that race.
Well, in Texas, right?
His
numbers
That's
are
right.
good. Although he couldn't win the House race, or the
that was last.
That was last time.
As DeMotto says, that was then, and this is now.
So can he be John Cornyn? That's the question.
I mean, I don't know about that, but he does seem a little naive in all of this, and I think he seems naive about running in this country, where I think you have to, you know, there's ways people run, and I don't think he knows all of them.
All right, let's stop there for a moment. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll have letters, and we'll talk about other stuff. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will be right back after this short break.
I'll set you free. If I was you, I'd leave.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. Welcome back to our panel. It is very nice to have you with us. Alan Chartok is here. We have Jen Smith, Judy Patrick, and Fran Berman, and we welcome your letters. We have letters. They are about Epstein. They are about polling. They're about all kinds of things.
So wow, there's a lot of them.
Yeah, so let's go to those. Joe writes to us and says about Epstein, the same questions of oversight were raised when Whitey Bulger was inexplicably transferred within the federal system to perhaps the most dangerous prison generally, and also specifically for him. He was dead within a day. Money will corrupt. I'll let that stand in the wilderness of silence. Mm-hmm. Wendy says, if only the Attorney General and the President had as much compassion for almost anyone as they do for Jeffrey Epstein.
That's a fair statement, I guess.
Hello, panel from Barbara. Someone, please look at the federal prison budget. What has been cut by this administration? What monies have been sent elsewhere, like the border? Why? Where and for how long are federal prisons understaffed? Those are questions.
Oh, great questions.
Good questions.
Vincent says, Alan is absolutely correct when it comes to polling. There are a tremendous amount of closeted Trump supporters, plain and simple. Bob says about presidential prognosticators, Alan repeatedly claims that the New York Times has been reporting that Trump has a good chance of being reelected. I read the New York Times every day and haven't seen any such articles. Though Nate Silver has from time to time pointed out what his path to reelection might be. Alan, please be specific if you're going to make such claims.
I read it. Now go back and read it yourself.
Federal prison, says John.
I want to sound like Chris Cuomo.
Oh, can we talk about that story? Can we talk about that story? I mean, let me get to John's letter. All right, I won't turn off John. And then John says, we've been for decades shortchanging and starving federal domestic programs and overstocking and overspending on military programs and ill-advised military adventures. Is it any wonder that domestic systems and infrastructures are breaking down? It's evidence that we are rotting from the inside out.
Very dramatically put.
With a lot of truth underscoring
and
it.
And a lot of truth.
All right. So when it comes to the, let's go to the.
Tell us about Chris Cuomo.
Okay. Thank you very much. So on the front page of the New York Post today, Godbrother Chris Cuomo fury as at the Fredo insult. I'm going to not read from the Post, however, I'm going to read from the Washington Post, not the New York Post. Trump is blasting CNN's Chris Cuomo over video threatening a man who called him Fredo. So all of this happened that the president started blasting Chris Cuomo for this profanity-laced video showing the CNN anchor threatening to throw a man down the stairs. Trump said the journalist resembled, quote, a total out-of-control animal, and in tweets suggested he would not be allowed weapons under red flag laws that help authorities take guns from people deemed dangerous. The video, which surfaced Monday night, shows Cuomo threatening a man for calling him Fredo after the fictional character Fredo Corleone from the Godfather films. But the core of the backlash centered on one claim from Cuomo that calling an Italian person Fredo was comparable to using the N-word, an assertion that had many Italian Americans scratching their heads and other critics calling Cuomo out of bounds. Cuomo asked the group of men involved in the confrontation, "Are any of you Italian? It's an insult to your people. It's like the N-word for us." The video sparked Trump's latest criticism of an anchor that he had at times singled out for displeasure amid attacks on CNN, one of several media organizations the president often targets as purveyors of fake news. On Monday night, CNN said it stood by its host. Chris Cuomo defended himself when he was verbally attacked with the use of an ethnic slur in an orchestrated setup. Cuomo tweeted on Tuesday that he appreciates the support he has gotten, but acknowledges he should be better than the guys baiting him.
Okay, Joe, as the only person in America who has never seen the Godfather movies, can you tell me who Fredo was?
Actually, I must admit, I have never seen the Godfather movies.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, so, okay, so who's Fredo, and why was he a bad guy?
Okay,
and...
so I'm the ranking expert.
Okay, good, okay. Good.
On the movie, because I've seen it 108 times. In fact, I've seen it so many times, I can generally do the words as before they come out of people's mouths. The classic line, of course, is, "Fredo, I knew it was you. I knew it was you all along." Fredo was the weakest of the brothers. The older brother got killed. Michael becomes the godfather. The youngest brother, Fredo, double crosses Michael.
Fredo was the backstabber.
Yeah, but he says he's so weak. He's just so weak that's what it's about. Look, I think this story is an important story and a warning to all of us with tempers. And that is, don't let them bait you. Chris Cuomo was exactly right. The guy baited him, and he went for it. He shouldn't have done it. His daughter was there. His wife was there. Nevertheless, you know, this is where self-control becomes extremely important. If when I read my mail and somebody starts using the F word or all the rest of it, I immediately get a hold of myself and put it into what I call a PIA file. You'll have to figure out what that is, what that means. And I don't go for it. I don't write them back. If somebody writes me a letter and it's interesting and intellectually interesting, I usually, but not always, because we get a lot of letters, answer it. But when they try to bait me, you got to know what they're doing. They're baiting you, and he knows it now.
Cuomo told them, "I'll effing ruin your S. I'll effing throw you down these stairs."
You know, this is something my two-year-old grandson is learning in daycare now. And what they teach him to say is, walk away. Mm-hmm. You know, if in a bad situation,
exactly.
Walk away.
Yep.
This is incredible that we have people, high-profile people, people in positions of authority and positions we turn to give us important information, and then they can't control their temper. This is something people should learn before they turn 5.
That's right.
And at the same time, I mean, you know, I appreciate, you know, the status that Chris Cuomo has, but I mean, I question like the validity of this is even a story. I don't think it's a figure.
Wouldn't
it's
be a story without that video.
So reactionary, and I think that's it. I mean, it's definitely the video, but I mean, like, there's so many videos out there of so many other people having a bad day, and I think it sort of detracts from other issues where, you know, he's talking about the N-word, where, like, you know, people are taking video of people who are wigging out on people who are, you know, black for being in a store or something like that. And, you know, I think they're just bigger issues.
Have you ever lost it? Have you ever lost it? Really lost it?
Me?
Yeah.
No. You can ask my colleagues. I think only once I've actually, like, yelled at someone over the phone. in my 14-year career.
But isn't this also a story because he's the governor's brother. His father was Mario Cuomo. I mean, that sets this up to a different level.
Right.
But
you're right.
It's also a story about living in a world where surveillance is common. You know, whether you're taking videos, whether it's a camera, it's so everything that you would think of that's within the realm of normal or extreme behavior is recorded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I love what you said before.
The accountability is just, you know, is really beyond what we learned when we were kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you who said it before? You, I think Joe may have said it before you were 5 years old. It's all acceptable.
That's
all
Judy.
Acceptable.
Yeah,
yeah, Judy. It's all acceptable until you're five.
Yeah.
And then if you punch the guy in the nose, it becomes something else. Right. So yes, it is about self-control. And Joe, I really like what you said. It was the father. The father is Mario, and the brother is Andrew. This guy's been on the tube constantly duking it out with these people. And by doing this, he undermined his own credibility. I think that's true.
And the other thing, too, is that, I mean, whether you like it or not, that being a public figure, you are held to a higher standard. And it's different than, I mean, you mentioned horrible things being said to the people and those videos going viral of people saying horrible things to flight attendants and airplanes and stuff. And yes, those are awful. But obviously it becomes a story when people know who the players are. Mm-hmm. And if you're baited and you just go for it, man. Mm-hmm. But I watched it a couple times. It's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. I forget what this website was. It was like Grouchy Waitress or something. Maybe the one of the readers or one of the listeners know the real thing.
I want it to be Grouchy Waitress. I don't care whether it is or not. I want it to be that.
Yeah,
you know, Billy Martin would walk into a bar. Right, Joe?
Right. Yeah.
Billy Martin would walk into a bar and there would be a fist fight, 10 minutes later. People knew that he could not control his temper.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, he became, fodder for it. I was half a unit, as in the Chartok twins, and the Chartok twins were getting into fights all the time. And it was never a pleasant thing that it happened. So you really learn somehow, you hope you learn, not to do it.
So this Grouchy Waitress website, Alan, had, celebrities going out, for a Happy Meal with their kids or going out, for an anniversary or something like that. And the people who waited on them, and they would rank them as to whether, they were good customers or whether they tipped them well or, something like that. And, it's sort of like every aspect of your life, whether you're doing your professional thing or not. Is kind of, fair game. Mm-hmm. And, it's got to be, the thing that I love about science is you could be a Nobel Prize winner and nobody knows who you are in the line at the cleaners. Mm-hmm. You're still waiting. You still, are happy or sad when you get your clothes back. It's sort of we have, as a discipline, that kind of invisibility that allows you to lead a normal life. But that's not true of politicians and celebrities and sports figures and other people like that.
So, go ahead.
There's no indication that this is a pattern with Chris Cuomo. It seems like an isolated incident entirely.
No.
Yep.
So let's talk about other very famous people. Editors of the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
The New York Times has demoted an editor over controversial tweets. I'm sure the Media Project will delve into this, but I would like to talk about it just for a little bit. The New York Times is demoting its deputy Washington editor, Jonathan Weissman, over a pair of controversial tweets, removing him as a congressional editor and saying he will no longer be active on social media. Jonathan Weissman met with the Times executive editor and apologized for his recent serious lapses in judgment as a consequence of his actions. He has been demoted and will no longer be overseeing the team that covers Congress to be active on social media. We don't typically discuss personal matters, but we're doing so in this instance with Jonathan's knowledge, that according to a Times spokesperson.
Can you, Joe, can you tell us?
Yes.
Because I read the thing four times. I couldn't figure out what the tweet was.
So, in July, Weissman deleted a tweet that outraged many, in which he wrote that saying Democratic Representatives Tlaib and Ilhan Omar were from the Midwest was like saying that Representative Lloyd Doggett of Austin is from Texas or Representative John Lewis is from the Deep South. Weissman was accused of racism over the tweets. AOC retweeted the post and said they literally are, and this comment is what erasure looks like. Omar also responded to the tweet saying that this will certainly be news to people of Minnesota's 5th District. Weissman also faced criticism last week after saying that the organization Justice Democrats was backing a primary challenger, Morgan Harper, against Representative Joyce Beatty of Ohio, who is black. Harper responded that she is also African-American. He's been accused of emailing author Roxane Gay, accused Weissman of emailing her after she mocked the tweets, telling her that she owed him an enormous apology for accusing him of racism and incompetence. So then the New York Times, what I was reading just then was from The Hill. The New York Times did their own take on this and said that a Times editor is demoted as the paper discusses its coverage of race. And the New York Times said in a statement that Weissman, a deputy editor of The Times, has been demoted and would no longer oversee the paper's congressional correspondence. They called what he did serious lapses in judgment. And the paper says that the reprimand came amid a broader discussion in The Times newsroom of how the paper covers race in the Trump administration in a polarized time.
All right, and Joe, could you also, because into all of this comes this other issue, which is the famous headline in which the Times was accused of soft peddling what the president was saying. Could you go into that at all?
Well, it doesn't
touch on race.
It doesn't touch on race, and it doesn't. This guy didn't have anything to do with that headline.
No, but Bakay did.
Yes.
The editor did, and he had to apologize for that. And I believe it was the Times, and, you know, we don't usually do this, but it was the Times, I believe, or The Hill, that mentioned that Bakay is of color himself, and the editor-in-chief, which I thought was strange in that it had to be mentioned.
And so,
yes,
it
is interesting.
And the headline was, Trump urges unity versus racism.
Yes, and, that was the headline.
Yeah.
And they got severely criticized for it as opposed to downplaying what Trump was really doing there, almost as if they were soft-peddling what Trump was saying.
You know, first of all, can I talk about the tweets? Because just like so many tweets, it's hard to fathom what exactly they were trying to say in the first instance. Mm-hmm. That's why you had to read it 4 or 5 times, Alan, to even try to make sense of it.
Exactly right.
And the tweets are often so snarky. They're so insider information that they're
out of context.
Out of context, and totally out of context. Most newspapers or media companies have social media policies, but you can have as many policies and directives as possible, but it still is not going to prevent the fact that when you are employed by a newspaper or a media company and you tweet something, you are, in essence, tweeting for the whole company, even though you think it's your own opinion.
Mm. Right, and isn't his job to be neutral? So this is not a neutral tweet.
Well, and I think that sort of gets to the heart of it is that, you know, that your personal views are showing when you shouldn't be, and unless you're an opinion columnist or an editor, you know, that's really not where it should be, and so it doesn't look comely on a senior editor at all. And I think as far as like the New York Times goes, in dealing with issues of race, I feel like they're a publication who both really examined it, but also like any outlet have a long way to go. I mean, I'm a subscriber to they have a newsletter that's called Race Related, which delves into a lot of these issues that go across the country. It's definitely different when you're dealing with someone within your own, but it is about newsroom and culture and policy. And newsrooms have historically been white male. And those demographics are barely nudging, though, you know, some places they are changing. But But again, language matters, especially in language that doesn't get erased.
So let me ask all my journalism friends here. So,
exactly.
To Alan's point, Dane Biquette, he himself was on the defensive as he fielded questions, comments, and criticism for more than an hour in a newsroom-wide staff meeting. The Weissman affair was part of the discussion, as was the headline that we just mentioned. The headline inspired "Cancel My Subscription" outrage among liberals who said it soft-pedaled Trump's role in creating the very conditions he claimed to be addressing in the wake of the mass shootings. So, what happens when your staff turns on you when they're the ones who start to bring you to task?
It happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great thing about being an editor of a newspaper. You got a room full of people who challenge authority and your position of authority, and they like to challenge you. And when you're an editor, they're challenging you all the time. You get used to that. I'm sure he's used to it.
The Washington Post put it this way: "The internal dissension and various controversies reinforce the contentious atmosphere that seemed to surround the New York Times."
They have a good lawyer writing that up, huh?
Yeah. How's that? All right.
So is there, really quickly, is there a rule that comes out of all of this? If you're a journalist and you're covering Congress or editing in Congress, don't tweet.
Well, you know, I think some old-fashioned editors would wish there was such a rule,
right.
But I think that you have to acknowledge the social media climate today requires people to tweet and to put some of their
own... But tweet
own
the facts.
Facts. But you're seeing lots of opinion in tweets.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think don't tweet gets closer to it.
All right. We're out of time. My thanks to everybody. Alan, Jen, Judy, Fran, thank you all very much. Be well.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
Have a good day.